So as we enter Perek Tesvav here of, or conclude Perek Tesvav of Parshas Bereishis, so there are a few, two significant issues I'd like to just touch on this morning. So Perek Tesvav opens up with Achar and V'Me'ela. After these things, Hashem spoke to Avram and telling him, don't be afraid, I'll save you and you'll get a lot of reward. And Avram says to Hashem, what are you going to give me? Vani alei chariri, I don't have any, I'm going to go alone, I don't have any children. Ven mesek besi, hu demesek Eliezer. And I only have in my house, I have Eliezer. You haven't given me any kids. Vinei ben besi, yoresh osi. So there's no son to inherit me. So the Emek Davar and others are concerned with the question that, wait a second, Avram was already promised that he was going to have children like the sand of the sea. Not the stars in the sky, that comes later, but the sand by the sea.
Right.
Sand by the sea. Right, you're going to have children like the sand of the sea. So was Avram lacking some amount of emunah here? Did Avram not believe that he was actually going to be getting that? Why was he dead? Why did he need to be reassured he was going to have children when he was already promised that he was going to have children? So the Netziv explains, and the in the Sefer Shemin HaTov also has a pshat in this as well, along these lines as well, that Avram was not asking whether he was going to technically have children. Rather, his question was, even though he believed that he was going to have children, I'm reading the Netziv now, the Emek Davar, that I wasn't going to have zera, according to my way and according to my desires. That my desire is to impact to take root, lahashrish, to cause to take root belief in Hashem amongst my children. And after I've gotten so old, I don't have any children, so he turns to Hashem and says, yes, it's true, you might be giving me children, but they're not going to be my children. Technically, they'll be mine, they'll be my biological children, but if I don't have the opportunity to be able to train them, grow them, teach them, so then they're not going to be my children. I want to have a piece of that. So we quoted a couple of weeks ago in Shul from Professor Dr. Clayton Christensen. Clayton Christensen was a teacher at Harvard Business School. I believe he's retired from Harvard now, but he wrote a book entitled How Will You Measure Your Life? I recommend it. It is not necessarily recommended to people in my shul because I like using it for openers. But it's about 12 chapters of business lessons that he applies to Musar ideals. So one of them is the idea of outsourcing. That at what point does it become too much of what one outsources? And he brings the example of Dell Computers. That Dell Computers was originally a very large business, and then they started. Then a company in Taiwan came to them, Asustet, and offered that we could start doing parts of it. We could start making your motherboards, and Dell agreed. And then they said we could oversee the assembly, and Dell said fine, and that improved their bottom line. And then finally they said we'll manage your entire supply chain, and to which Dell said okay. And before they knew it, this company, Asustet, was making the entire computers. And then they actually put on the market their own computers. They were making the entire computers and then slapping a Dell brand on them. And then they were being sold as Dell computers. So then Asustet said, well, why are we bothering with the Dell computers? Let's just manufacture our own computers and we'll call them Asustet computers, which they do. So now you can buy in the store Dell computers and Asustet computers. Asustet computers are going to be cheaper than the Dell computers. Dell is the name brand, and Asustet is the other leading brand. And they end up being the same computers, the same exact computers from the same exact spot. So his ha'ara is that Dell continued to outsource and outsource and outsource until they weren't involved with the process at all, and the thing that they were trying to create took on an entire life of its own, which was separate and distinct from Dell. Now, he adds in that chapter that Dell might have been okay with that, because Dell moved on to other aspects of their business. But he has a whole, and those business people amongst us might have a greater grasp of what he was talking about. But he says the reason what's in it for them to outsource is because there's some kind of ratio that people judge the value of stocks on, which is the amount of profit you have versus the amount of hard assets, or the amount of not hard assets, but the amount of costs that you have. So the more things that you're actually making yourself, your costs are going up. So by outsourcing a lot of stuff, you're driving your costs down, but you're maintaining your profitability, in which case you're raising your profit-to-cost ratio. But Christensen points out that that's a faulty premise. That's not a great way to judge a business, because if you're going to keep outsourcing stuff, eventually it's going to dry up everything, and you're not going to be able to maintain the profitability either. So bring back that to over here, that was Avram's complaint. Avram said, I want to make sure that I'm involved and I'm embedded and I'm actually involved in creating the son. I don't want to just outsource it all to Eliezer. I want to do it the hard way. There is a story that I heard recently from the biography of Rav Eliashiv. Whenever I'm at someone's house that has that biography, I read it, but I'm only about the fifth of the way in now. Apparently there is a story of Rav Eliashiv, that Rav Eliashiv had thousands of descendants by the time he passed away. I have a cousin in Israel who's a Mashkiach, and he actually switched yeshivas recently. He has a son or daughter, I think a daughter, who married a great-grandson of Rav Eliashiv already 7 or 8 years ago. Yashiv was a Masada Kedusha, then he left. He doesn't have time. All of these 8 o'clock, he has too many of them to keep track. So, or I should say to keep track, I'm not sure that's the appropriate way, but he had to give a shir, so he came as a Masada Kedusha, and then went back and gave a shir later that night. So apparently he had a 6th-generation boy born, so a great-great-great-grandson was born during his lifetime. And they came to him and they said, you know, we'd like you to be the Sanduk. And not only is it exciting for you to be the Sanduk, because you have a lot of nachas that it's your great-great-great-grandson, but apparently there is a statement in the Zohar that anybody who is able to be, or in Kabbalah someplace, that anybody who is able to be the Sanduk at their great-great-great-grandson automatically has a clear pathway into Olam Haba. So that's a pretty good deal. So Rav Eliashiv told them, no. He said, I don't want to do it. They went to him and says, why not? Why wouldn't you want to be the Sanduk for such things? He says, plus when I go to Olam Haba, I want to get in the right way. I want to go in the front door. I don't want to use any of these back entrances. Right? So that
no is smooth sailing.
That is what to be said. So he probably had a pretty good ticket into the front door as well. But he didn't want any of these outs. He wanted to be able to do it all through his own work and his own efforts and abilities, etc. Okay, so that is issue number one. Yes.
How do we understand Avraham Avinu's point here as not having enough emunah in Hashem?
No, but Hashem.
He's going to hang around long enough to do this with his kids when he gets his kids.
The promise was that you're going to have a lot of kids. So Avraham turned around. So the question is, why did Avraham have enough emunah? Why did he require another promise from Hashem? The answer is because the original promise, as Avram understood it, was only that he was going to have a lot of biological kids.
Okay.
So that's true. Avram didn't doubt that, but Avram said, I want more. I don't want to just be the father of kids. I want to be involved in their growth and their development and their search for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I want to be involved in their chinuch. I want to be able to teach them. So that answers the question.
Well, he's older now. There aren't any kids yet.
So that's what this promise was. This promise was that you're going to have a kid that you're going to be able to work with.
And the first promise was the dust of the earth. This promise is the stars in the heaven. It's a big deal. Each entity is a big deal.
Yeah, there is a drasha about that. That stars in that sand is in terms of its mass, while stars are particular individuals. Yes, I think I've given that drasha at some point somehow in the past. Yeah. Good. So that is issue number one over the course of the parsha. Now the parak continues, as you pointed out. So he gets a lot of flack. Hashem tells him that I'm going to take your people out, and then they're going to. And they're going to inherit this land, right? He says in Pasuk Zayin, "Vayomri Elav Ani Hashem Asher Tzivsicha Mi'orkasim." I took you from Orkasim, Laseis Lacha Esaras Azos L'Rishta, to give you this land as your inheritance. So Avram responds, "Vayomer Adonai Elokim Bameida Ki Irashena." How do I know? How do I know that we're going to inherit this land? So the Gemara in the Nedarim says that that was a bad name. That was a bad thing that Avram just did. Amar Shmuel, if they ma nenesh Avram Avinu shenishtavdu banim l'mitzrayim. Well, for what reason was Avram punished that his children were going to go down to Mitzrayim ma'asayim b'yasar shanim for 210 years? Shehivriz al midosav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu shamar v'meidav. Was he doubted? He cast doubt on the midos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu by the fact that he said, b'me'idah. He said, how do I know? So therefore, B'nai Yisrael was punished with going down to Mitzrayim. Now, there are actually, in that Gemara, this is one of four things. The Gemara there asks the question, why did Avram's descendants get punished with going down to Mitzrayim? It actually gives four things in that Gemara that Avram did wrong over the course of his life and blames it on that. Now, I would add, I recall seeing that this isn't the reason. I mean, if it wasn't for the one could get the impression from that Gemara that if Avram hadn't done this, the Bnei Yisrael wouldn't have gone down to Mitzrayim and been slaves for 210 years. That's not necessarily true. What that might have needed to happen anyways. What might be the punishment here is that Avram didn't necessarily need to know about it. The story about Bnei Yisrael going down to Mitzrayim is the next section in the Chumash. So why does Avram need to know about that? That's bad news. That's something a parent wants to know, that after you pass away, your son's going to have this tzaras and your daughter's going to have this sickness, etc. Why do they need to know? So that was the punishment. The punishment was Avram should have died thinking that everything's going to be wonderful, and instead he's told that bad things are coming. And why? Why did Avram? Because Avram was it was the one who said the thing that was wrong. Okay. Either way, the pasuk then continues on and describes the bris ben habesarim. So how do we understand that? So why did he do it? So the Torah Temima and others explain that Avram's question was not how do I know that this is going to happen. His question was how do I know that my children are going to deserve it. That I can guarantee that in terms of going to Eretz Yisrael, I mean, Avram is told, why did he ask for a sign now? Avram is told, go to the land of Israel and you're going to have children, you're going to have a lot of wealth. And he's told to do a lot of things, and Avram seems to do all of them without making a request for some kind of sign, some kind of proof that such a thing is going to happen. Why all of a sudden here does Avram say, wait a second, I want some kind of sign that this is going to come true? So the Torah Temima explains that all the other ones were things that Avram needed to do. Avram is told, you go to the land of Canaan, and you're going to have become wealthy, and you're going to have a lot of stuff, and everything's going to work out. All right? When it comes to your children inheriting the land of Israel, so that's not so sure that it's going to happen. It's sure that it's going to happen, but Hashem says to Avram, but Avram says, how do I know that my children are still going to deserve it? I can maintain my emunah, I can guarantee my faith, my part of the deal, and you're going to maintain your part of the deal, obviously. But how do I know that my children are going to maintain their part of the deal? So Hashem's response is, what is Hashem's response to that? All right, what is the proof, ultimately, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu offers? The proof that Hashem offers is the bris ben habesarim. Right, we're going to cut up these different animals, and you're going to walk between them, and I'm going to walk between them, and that's going to be the sign. That's right. That's ultimately the sign that Hashem gives. The sign that, how do I know that that's going to come true? Hashem says, well, take me these animals, divide them up into three, take me three of these animals, three of that animal, three of the other animals, cut them up, and we're going to walk between them. How does that answer the question? So the way when I learned Parshas Lech Lecha as a, like a second or third grader. So the pshat that you get in the bris ben habesarim is that this is the way people made deals. Right? This is the, you cut something up, you agree on it, this is like a strong form of shaking on it. What is the significance of taking an animal, cutting it in half, and walking in between? So we mentioned it in passing, Rashi, that Rashi explains for all of these different animals what they all signified, and they all signified korbanos. They all signified different types of offerings that were brought for different kinds of needs. That they would have the agalim represent the parim, that par is brought it represents these types of korbanos, and the goats are these types of korbanos, all that are representing different types of sacrifices that are being offered. So the Gemara in Tainus says as follows: Amar Avram lifnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam, Shem Yisrael chotin lefanecha, yata usa lehem kedor hamabul v'kedor haflaga. That Avram, it's a Gemara in Tainus, that Avram says to Hashem, how do I know maybe Bnei Yisrael is going to sin, and you're going to make to them like you did to the Dor HaMavul, like to the Dor HaFlaga, that you're going to destroy them? All right, which is kind of the explanation that we gave. Avram is saying, how do I know that this is going to happen? How do I know my children aren't going to sin? And the extension of that is the next pasuk when Avram turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and says, that's the Gemara in the Dharm. Gemara in Tainus is, Avram says to Hashem, maybe they're going to sin, and you're going to destroy them. How do I know this is going to come true? So Amar lo, lav, Amar lefanav ha-me'ida, Amar lo kachali egla mishuleshes. How do you know? Take from me these things. And the Torah Tamimah explains, what is the Gemara about bringing all these korbanos, about bringing all these animals signifying korbanos? Hashem is saying, they might sin, but don't worry, there's a way out. There's a way out. What is the way out for them? How might it be that they're going to make mistakes and they're going to sin, but yet they're still going to be the inheritors of the land? The process of tshuva. And the process of teshuva is represented by the various korbanos that are offered here. So that I think clarifies a lot about the Bris Ben Havisarim. The Bris Ben Havisarim is not just about some kind of pact where they're slaughtering a lot of animals. Bris Ben Havisarim is the paradigm of teshuva and human existence and the future of the Jewish people all wrapped into one. Now, the truth is we don't have korbanos, but we have things that replace korbanos. Our things that replace korbanos is the idea of teshuvah and the idea of tefillah. And there's various several gemaras that talk about different things taking the place of korbanos. So we have things that take the place of korbanos, but all of that is emanating back to the Bris and Abbasarim. The guarantee of the Jewish people being able to reside in the land of Israel is not about that they are a perfect people or that they are going to be a perfect people. The guarantee is that even when they are not a perfect people, there's going to be a way for them to be able to get up, brush themselves off, do what we need to do in order to find ourselves back in the favor of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and be able to move on from there. Okay, I guess we'll stop here.
What's the significance of shooing away the birds of prey that came down?
Yeah, I don't know. I raised that question. We went through it the other day. I don't have an answer yet as to what the significance of those animals. Okay.